It's the Frank Five Fellows podcast series, informal conversations with recent liberal arts grads. They're in business, they're engineers, they're educators, and they're artists. What's on the minds of recent graduates? What are the fellows thinking about? In this episode, find out, it's everything. Listen to the fellows talk about Russia, theater, baseball, and a host of other topics. Up next, Kimberly St. Julian Varnon and Saeed Atchan.
Now, I know that at some point you discovered an interest and what became a real passion for the study and learning of the Russian language, as well as an interest in Slavic studies and European studies, Eastern European studies. So how on earth did you discover this intellectual curiosity?
Honestly, this obsession I've had started in sixth grade. I was homesick. I had perfect attendance every year, but I was sick at home, and there was this 8-hour long documentary on the History Channel called Russia, Land of the Tsars. And by the time I finished this 8-hour long documentary, my fever had broken and I was obsessed with Russia. And I never had a chance to like engage this obsession until I went to Swarthmore and I was looking at the course catalog, and it had this first year seminar called Angels of Death, Russia under Lenin and Stalin. And I was like, this is my life's work right here.
Wow.
So I took the class and I was obsessed with it. It was with Dr. Weinberg. And I decided that I needed more of that in my life. So I took more European classes and more Eastern European classes. The idea of nations and nationalism really interests me. And so part of wanting to be a Soviet historian is learning Russian. And I was taking French at Swarthmore. And then during my study abroad year, I took Russian because I was doing some research over the summer at Swarthmore, and I heard Professor Sibylline Forrester speaking Russian on the phone. And I just fell in love with the language and decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to focus on Soviet history. So I started taking Russian, and I love it. I think it's fascinating. I cannot tell you that this is a healthy obsession, but I love it.
And so how many people of color are in this field? What is that like?
There are very few people of color in the field. There are more now than when I was doing my undergraduate work. It's weird because Swarthmore has been really good at producing Slavicists who are people of color. And when we went to the Slavic conference my senior year, and I started meeting other people of color who were working in Slavic studies, and most of them are doing Russian and Slavic literature and languages. So I was kind of the only person doing history, but to see other people of color doing it, and we didn't feel, there were probably about a handful of us at that point. And I was talking to them about Swarthmore. I was like, yeah, my best friend Jackie, who's also, you know, a Black woman. But yeah, we take Russian. And then there was Latavia, who took Russian. She was 2 years older than us. And she was doing a Fulbright in Kazakhstan. So we're like, yeah, SWAT, this is kind of normal where you have, you know, Black women speaking Russian. And then there was another girl taking Russian. She was a freshman when we were seniors. And she was Black and she was taking Russian. And so when we go to these Slavic conferences and they're just kind of obsessed with this, you know, POC powerhouse of Russian that Swarthmore has, and they asked us how SWAT did it. And we just said they let us. They never told us we couldn't. The idea that our skin color was somehow strange to speaking Russian never came up. And so I think that has helped, and I'm part of a group that helps to spread diversity in Slavic studies to all people of color, but also LGBTQ community, because it's very small, and Slavic studies is still predominantly, you know, non-people of color, it's still predominantly male. And as more and more people are getting into it, I think it's becoming more diverse, but we still have a long fight. And being a Black woman who's doing Soviet history, I think I'm one of two or three that I know about around the country So I think it's important, and I'm glad Swarthmore let me do that and never told me I couldn't do it or that it was strange that a person of my color would be doing something like that.
Up next, Nell Bong-Jensen and Tim Burke.
Well, so that's another interesting thing, right? We make a lot of claims here, and I think every institution that calls itself liberal arts, that we're helping you to be ready for an uncertain world, for changing circumstances, to be adaptive, to be flexible. As you look down the road now, 10, 20 years out, what do you see coming in the work that you're doing that you either feel ready for or unready for? I mean, what's your future look like now as you imagine it outward?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think I'll talk about the field first and then about myself. I think the field of theater is actually in a really exciting time, in part because of timing. I think when the regional theater movement started in the States in the 70s, a lot of artists were put in charge and who are now retiring. So there's just a lot of movement in the field. There's a lot of openings of leadership positions around the country. And there's going to be a lot of people filling them and a lot of talk about making sure a lot of those slots are filled by women and people of color, which they have not historically been. So I'm really excited to see how that shapes the field as a whole. I think theaters are in a little bit of a crisis in that for most regional theaters, the average subscriber is a white woman over the age of 55. And I think, you know, as sort of the next generation comes, who's a generation very used to getting the entertainment they want on demand on their phone anytime, saying, no, you should show up at a theater at a specific time and place. It's going to be worth it, I promise, is a really hard challenge. And I don't know that it's always worth it. You know, there's a lot of really good TV out there right now. So I think it's actually a great challenge for the field of, okay, how do we create work that's different from what people are watching on a screen? What's different about a theatrical experience? And how can we be more inclusive so that different kinds of people want to come be a part of it? And that's part of why I'm really interested in this work of making theater with people outside of the industry, because I think if we're not making it with them, we can't say that it's for them. So those are sort of developments in the field I'm really excited for.
Up next, Marissa Davis and Rachel Burma.
Is there anything else that in these last couple of minutes that you'd like to say or revise or return to? We've talked about a lot of different topics.
There's, you know, one of the questions that you'd asked me just about my experiences in college and then the mm-hmm. moments at which I've learned either more about myself or had discovered something, some kind of learning either in or outside of the classroom. I think mm-hmm. I actually think about a really important learning that is, or I guess discovery in many ways, that I still take with me now. Mm-hmm. And that's just rooted in this idea that, one, I am not perfect. And not only is that okay, but it's also the idea of being perfect is also this, it's unhealthily unrealistic, you know, that being human is first and foremost what we should be focusing on. And I think so often, particularly within classrooms and colleges and workplaces where there is a lot placed on being really high achieving, I think there's this spoken or unspoken rule or idea that you're supposed to be really perfect and be really good. Mm-hmm. Good at what you do. And in some way sacrifice everything else in order to be that good. And I think once I just came to terms with the fact that, hey, the best thing I can do is just be a solid and whole human being and enjoy the things that I do, it actually isn't that I'm going to yield or get to this place of perfection, but I get to a place that is still helpful and is still productive.
Up next, Kara Peterman and Elizabeth Stevens.
Can you remember or tell me about a time when you kind of knew you were in the right place when you came to Swarthmore? Like, I'm not sure what your college selection process was, but when was a time where you felt like, oh, this is where I should be? This is right for me.
I actually applied to Swarthmore Early Decision and got in. So I was pretty convinced it was the right place for me when I even just visited campus. I can honestly say I felt it was the right place when I just discovered Swarthmore as a student applying. I remember just reading about various things, like how quirky some of the courses were, at least from my perspective as a high schooler. I went to a very large public high school, and while we had a large swath of courses to take, you know, it was all bread and butter classes. There were no interesting seminars. There were no, diverse music groups or anything like that. And I remember I saw the Balinese gamelan course. And as it was, I had been to Bali and I'd heard the gamelan musicians in the street. And I thought, wow, they have a course on Balinese gamelan? That's, I mean, it was incredulous to me. It was incredible. I thought it was insane, but also very attractive. My one regret is I never actually took Balinese gamelan at Swarthmore. So that was something that I still lives with me to this day. But that was just one of many things that I learned about Swarthmore that made me feel like it was the right place. And then it was just further confirmed when I got to campus and as a freshman or in orientation. And all of these things throughout my life, which had made me sort of an outsider, or not an outsider, but, you know, everyone did one thing and I did something else. Or I grew up in a foreign country and that made me different growing up. All of these things made me fit right in at Swarthmore. And it was one of the few instances of belonging I had truly felt at that point in my life. And just everything that made me weird or different was made me fit in perfectly at Swarthmore. And so that was very early on, as I said, the first week or so on campus.
Up next, Sam Sussman and Krista Thomason.
Tell me about your first day on the job.
Great. So I said the question that did it say, can I change it a little bit? Because I think it said your first day on your first job. And I was
I didn't realize it, but you were correct. It is first day on the first job. But yeah, I kind of want to know not about your first job. I want to know about this job.
Okay. All right. I'll do both if that's okay. And if one is really boring, you can, you know, cut it out.
Okay.
So when I was, this was the first day on the first job. When I was 14, someone offered me $15 to umpire a baseball game.
What?
And I'd been playing baseball all my life, loved baseball. And I was just getting to the age where it was really apparent that I wasn't very good at baseball. I had sort of strung along, you know, until 14, no one's that good.
Right.
So, you know, if you can kind of aim the ball, even if you throw it, you know, like 45 miles an hour, you might even get to pitch a few innings.
There you go.
You know, by 12, I'd reached the peak of my career. By 14, things were kind of on the down and out. So I was excited. All right, here's a new way to play baseball. And, you know, I showed up to the ballpark, and I crouched behind home plate, and, you know, the kids came out onto the field, and the pitcher had the ball, and he was looking, you know, staring down the batter, and these kids were maybe 11 or 12 years old. So I probably could have played competitively in that game. And then there was just this long pause, And the coaches stared at me and the players stared at me. And I was thinking, why aren't they playing? What's happening? And then I realized, oh, I have to say, play ball.
That's right.
So I said, play ball. And then the kids started playing baseball. And, you know, I think there's actually, for me, there's been an important parable in that experience. I've chosen to pursue career paths that rely a lot on self-initiative and for which there's no exact path going forward. And, you know, sometimes you just realize the only thing that people are waiting to happen is for you to say, play ball.
Right, right. I like that. I like that. There's something sort of, I mean, there's the sort of ritual of baseball, right? And that sort of element of it. But then, yeah, there are these times when you're oftentimes sort of looking around waiting for someone else to tell you what to do or waiting for someone else to say go. And actually, it turns out that you're the one that has to do it, right?
Yeah, yeah. You've got to say play ball.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by the Adelot Foundation and the Language and Media Centers at Swarthmore College. To learn more, visit www.swarthmore.edu/Adelot-Foundation. That's Swarthmore, Swarthmore, Adelot, AYDELOTTE, Foundation.